1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
I live most of my time in Washington, D.C., and it is just mind-blowing to see what is happening in Washington, D.C. That when that $40 billion package to Ukraine was voted on, in which almost half of it was for military, there wasn't a discussion on the House floor about that. There wasn't a hearing about it. And there wasn't one Democrat that voted against it. Not one. Not a member of the squad, not Barbara Lee, who was the one who voted against war after 9/11. None of them. A Democratic president, and they all voted for that package. There were 57 Republicans in the House that voted against it. There were 11 senators who voted against it. But that's a small handful as well. And some of them because they thought the enemy is China, and that's where we should be putting our sights. And others said it should be going to the border, to militarize our border, to make us safe from the hordes trying to come in. But very little discussion about Ukraine itself. And then I don't know if you followed what happened when afterwards, months later, there was a letter initiated by the head of the Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, that was saying, yes, we were giving the weapons and that was good and what Biden is doing is good, but on top of all that, it would be good to start some negotiations. A very, very, very mild letter. Well, a letter usually is out there for a week or two, and then that's the end. It's whoever signs it, signed it, and it's given in. Well, they had such a hard time getting Democrats to sign that letter. There are 100 members of the Progressive Caucus. They could not get 4/5 of that caucus to sign that letter. So they kept extending it and extending it. There were 5 people, there were 10 people. Finally, months later, they put it out with 30 members who had signed. And all hell broke loose. People started saying, wait, did I really sign that? Well, I don't remember having signed that. Well, take my name off that. And Nancy Pelosi coming down on them like a ton of bricks and saying, what are you doing? There's elections coming up. And the President Biden is the one who sets those policies. Why are you trying to second guess? Within 24 hours, I've never seen anything like this in my life. A letter that was signed, sealed, and delivered to President Biden was withdrawn. And there was only one person out of those 30 who didn't go back on it. Only one person who came out publicly and said, of course, that was a rational thing to call for negotiations. And that was Ro Khanna from California. It is very, very strange when you see somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene in the Republican Party having one of the most rational voices when it comes to Ukraine. You have to say, what is going on in our country? And one thing that is going on is when it's a Democrat in the White House, you get very, very little response because the Republicans are mostly war hawks all the time. And the Democrats, you know, sometimes I think if it were Trump in the White House, we would have some Democrats with us. But you also have to look at what the media is doing. And I have never seen a campaign like this. We've seen campaigns to sell the war in Iraq. We've seen campaigns to sell other wars. This one is on a whole different level. When did you ever see the head of a country, a warring country, the president of a foreign country, come twice to address a joint session of Congress? He got 18 standing ovations. He has been on the cover of Vogue. He has been the person of the year of Time magazine. He addressed the Oscars. He addressed the Grammys. He addressed the Cannes Film Festival. He's come to every Davos and every important economic meeting addressing them. It is just amazing. The selling of Zelensky, the selling of this war. And this is what we're up against. Now, on the positive side, In the rest of the world, there is a lot of pressure to end this war. We're seeing that from the global south, where country after country are saying, we're not taking sides in this war. There's only one side for us, and that's the side of peace. You better sit down and come up with a solution, because you're hurting our people. You're hurting our people because of the price of energy. You're hurting our people because of the price of food. You're hurting our people because of the attention being taken away from the existential threat of the climate that is affecting people all over the world. And that's where we have to be putting our money. And you're hearing that from Europeans as well, because when this war started, the US and the NATO countries were all prepared with the sanctions against Russia. They thought they had it nailed. They thought when they put those sanctions into place, the Russian economy would just crumble. And guess what? It's been the opposite. The Russian economy has not crumbled because the price of oil has gone down recently, but it was way high and they made a lot of money from that. But the Europeans are paying the price of the cost of energy. The Europeans are saying that our dirty energy companies are war profiteers because they're selling the LNG and the oil to Europe at 4 or 5 times the price of what we are paying for it here. They're also saying that US weapons companies are the ones that are really the winners from this war. Not only are they the ones that are getting most of our taxpayer money that we're spending for this, but now the European countries are spending more on their military, and guess what? A lot of that is going to our weapons companies as well. So there's tremendous war profiteering going on, and there's growing anger. And in Europe, they are having demonstrations with tens of thousands of people on the street. It happened in East Germany, it's happened in the Czech Republic, it's happened in Italy, and it's happened in France, where they're coming out against the inflation, and they're connecting that to the issue of Ukraine. And so then here I come to what can we do? Because we're still at the point where we're not able to get large numbers of people out in the streets. One reason is because we have to do a better job educating, educating, educating. And we have an 18-minute video that you can see online. It's free. Please pass it around. We're showing it in college campuses all over the country. It's important to give people the facts about this. And we are, in small numbers, getting out in the streets and rallies, and I know you have ones here in your community that are happening in places all over the country, people going out to farmers markets, people sitting out with booths that say, come talk to me about Ukraine, let's just have a discussion. I was just in New York City. We had a very lively demonstration with a lot of young people, which was great to see. And the chant that they kept chanting was, money for the poor, not for war, money for the poor, not for war. They understand that their future is at stake. And so what we need to do is just find more ways to educate, to organize, and to mobilize. And one thing that I'm very excited about is that we managed right up into the lead up into the holiday season this year to work with groups like the Fellowship of Reconciliation to call for a Christmas truce. And we were aiming to get 100 religious leaders to sign on for that call. We got over 1,500 religious leaders in about 2 weeks' time. It showed how much they felt it was their calling, it was their duty to come out and be on record calling for peace talks. And that brings us full circle to Martin Luther King, who said it was his moral obligation. And whether we're doing this from a faith-based perspective, from an environmental perspective, or simply from a perspective that we don't like seeing people killed, we've got to find ways to convince others and then ultimately convince the people who hold the purse strings in Congress and the people who really can initiate talks not only with Russia, but push the Ukrainians to the peace table, and that is the White House. So thank you for listening to me. Thank you for the work you're doing. Let's see what we can do together to show that we are a nation that isn't going towards spiritual death, because we want to renew our spiritual faith in humankind by building a world without war. Thank you. Well, certainly we have a war economy, and I talked about the companies that profit from this war, but it's much larger than the companies because how smart these war manufacturers, these merchants of death, as the Pope calls them, have done their manufacturing in just about every single congressional district, so it becomes an issue about jobs, and it's an issue of tremendous corruption because the lobby groups for those weapons industries are in the halls of Congress constantly, and they are giving money to the campaigns of the congresspeople. And we know that people like the Secretary of Defense came to us directly from the board of Raytheon. I mean, how much more obvious can it be that this military-industrial congressional complex that Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, how it's become so humongous? And yes, it is the industrial basis of this country. It's terrible. Yeah.
It wasn't always so.
It wasn't always so, not at all. And you also brought up the issue of U.S. wanting to maintain hegemony in China. And I think it is so important when we talk about this to bring China into the picture because, you know, when the U.S. was bogged down, as they say, in the Middle East, and Obama was like, we got to pivot to Asia, we got to pivot to Asia. You know, they wanted to start setting their sights on China, but they were too involved in these wars in the Middle East. And now, involved in this war in Russia, but at the same time, NATO and the U.S. in its own security documents talks about our greatest adversary is China, which is ridiculous. There is no reason for us to treat China as an enemy. But China, unlike the U.S., is not going around the world using its military might. It's going around the world using its economic might with its Belt and Road Initiative and creating infrastructure projects that sometimes are bad projects that hurt the environment and can hurt people, and a lot of times are good projects that are actually win-win situations that make them friends. And so what is happening right now is that the U.S., and I think it was part of NATO's raison d'etre from the U.S. perspective, is to keep Europe in the U.S. realm and to stop it from going close to the Asian side. And when they were getting the energy from Russia, the U.S. didn't like that. And I remember being in some of these hearings in Congress and hear people from Texas, like Senator Ted Cruz, who were saying, we can't let that pipeline go through, that Nord Stream pipeline. We got to do something about that. And I kept thinking, well, wait, you know, they have the right to have their own Nord Stream pipeline with Russia if they want. And then, lo and behold, the Nord Stream pipeline is blown up. And we can't figure out who the heck might have blown that up? What about motive? Who didn't want to see it built to the begin with? Who said they could blow it up? Who gained from blowing it up? And Biden said it at a press conference. We're going to get rid of it. It's part of bringing Europe back into the fold of the U.S., making Europe dependent economically even more on the United States. But what it's doing is pushing Russia and China closer together, even though our mass media is usually saying, oh, the Chinese are criticizing the Russians and they don't like it. You know, the Chinese don't want the war, I don't think. They want to see Russia continue this war, but they are certainly increasing their trade with Russia right now. So in some ways, this is backfiring not only against Europe, but against the United States as well. And what we're also seeing is so many countries fed up with the U.S. imposing its economic sanctions on the rest of the world, whether it's Cuba or whether it's Venezuela or Syria or Korea, and now Russia and imposing sanctions on China, that they are starting bilateral trade outside the U.S. dollar. And there will be, probably in the lifetimes of the younger people here, a a complete revamping of the economic system so that the SWIFT system, which is dominated by the dollar and all financial transactions, will just be one of many ways to transfer funds. Well, that's right. And you might have heard of the entity called the BRICS, the alliance that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. It is a huge part of the world population and a huge part of the global economy. And now there are many, many other countries that want to join the BRICS. And this is really a reflection of the kind of blowback that the U.S. is getting from all of these wars, all of these sanctions that it imposes or tries to impose on the rest of the world. Yeah, as we talk about in the book, the neo-Nazi groups like the political parties did very poorly in the last election. They did not have a lot of political sympathy with the general population, but they have played an outsized role militarily because they had paramilitary groups that were armed, that went to the Donbas, that were fighting there, refused to step down, refused to comply with the Minsk Accords. They were the ones that threatened past presidents, including Zelensky, if they were going to actually go and meet with the leaders of the breakaway republics. And now they have been incorporated into the army. Some of you might remember Congressman John Conyers from the U.S. He was very active, a real icon in the civil rights movement. He passed a bill saying that no U.S. money could go to the Azov battalion because of their Nazi sympathies. That bill was taken up more recently, but now it doesn't mean anything because it's all one army. And you can't say, well, this can't go to this group because you couldn't tell in the battlefield. But certainly, when you have war, it is the most militant ones that actually have even more power. It doesn't come into the narrative because it doesn't fit within the narrative that the U.S. wants to put out there. It doesn't fit with the narrative of Zelensky being the greatest Democrat we've ever seen, and that we have to fight this war for democracy. And those who try to talk about it are silenced. But I think it is important to know that history, and it's an important element to discuss with people when we talk about the issue in Ukraine not being as, quote, black and white as it's made out to be. Well, I wish we had Ray McGovern with us here tonight because he could give us a much, much more insightful view of Putin than I can. What I do know is that when the Soviet Union broke apart and there was the what Naomi Klein calls the disaster capitalism that came in and the tremendous privatization of government enterprises and the plummeting of the well-being of the Russian people, the plummeting of the life expectancy of the Russian people, Vladimir Putin came in and got rid of a lot of the corruption, improved the economy, improved people's standard of living, and has been extremely popular because of that. And I have friends in Russia that I talk to all the time, including just today, who think that Putin has been a good leader. They, my friends, and it doesn't reflect, I don't know, you know, what the population thinks, think that this is a terrible mistake that he committed and that he has now boxed himself into a corner. Now, there are others who disagree and think that he knows what he is doing. I think that just like the U.S. has gotten terrible intelligence when it went into Iraq, when it went into Afghanistan, when it went into Libya, wherever, I think so is the case in Russia, where he got bad intelligence about what would happen with a Russian invasion. Inside Russia, he's now staked his reputation on this, which means he's not about to pull out and say, I made a mistake. That would be the end of him. I also think that it's not just Putin who wants to make sure that Crimea stays in the hands of Russia. That's a widespread feeling among a lot of Russians. I was told that they feel towards Crimea the way we feel towards Alaska, that it belongs to us, and that Putin is doing the right thing by trying to make sure that stays in the hands of Russia and protecting the Russian-speaking and the ethnic Russians in the Donbas. Now, there is tremendous censorship in Russia, just as there is tremendous censorship in Ukraine. And so it's hard to know what the Russian people are thinking and feeling. We do know that when people came out on the streets in Russia to protest, they've been arrested. We do know that when they called up 300,000 more reservists, thousands of young men of military age fled the country because they don't want to fight. We do know that there is an underground movement against the war in Russia. I think in the United States, we personalize it so much to be about Putin. But I think when it comes to Putin and Russia, there is a much larger group of nationalists in Russia who do feel that they have lost a lot of their prestige with the fall of the Soviet Union, that the U.S. has been trying to push them around, that they shouldn't allow the U.S. to push them around, they shouldn't have allowed the U.S. to expand NATO to the borders that it already is now. And so I think even with the censorship, it is a popular position inside Russia, that Russia is just trying to protect itself, and that having a stronghold of NATO on the border of Ukraine is an existential threat to Russia. Whether that's because of Russian propaganda or because it's the way they really feel, we have to recognize that sentiment goes way beyond Putin. So do we have any last comment, suggestion? Yes. Well, that's right. And when you say, you know, war, it has a cycle of its own, and it starts, and then, you know, you hate your opponent more because they killed your comrade or your son, or, you know, and that hate just keeps spinning and spinning and spinning. Absolutely. But, you know, that's why when you're especially now at war with nuclear power, if we go back to Martin Luther King, it's either nonviolence or non-existence. Thank you.
You were just listening to Medea Benjamin on the selling of the Ukraine war. She spoke in Chapel Hill, North Carolina on Martin Luther King Jr. Day in mid-January. Medea Benjamin is a renowned peace activist and social justice advocate. She is co-founder of Code Pink, author of many books. Her latest is War in Ukraine. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent progressive nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media. And we have a special series of programs on Ukraine featuring Katrina Vandenhoevel, Ray McGovern, John Mearsheimer, and Timothy Snyder. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Medea Benjamin on the Selling of the Ukraine War, and for her book, War in Ukraine, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Jerry Markatos. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Bob Dylan, with God on our side.
The Second World War came to an end. We forgave the Germans, and then we were friends. Though they murdered 6 million in the ovens they fried, the Germans now to have God on their side. I've learned to hate the Russians all through my whole life. If another war comes, it's them we must fight. To hate them and fear them, to run and to hide, and accept it all bravely with God on my side. But now we got weapons of chemical dust. If I them were forced to, then fire them we must. One push of the button and it shot the world wide. And you never ask questions when God's on your side.
I really know what to say about it, other than it's hard as a bro. Heard it like 3 different ways now. Hard not to think about when you gon' go.
Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
state in the